Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
That was a rigged election, and it's a shame that we had to go through it. It's very bad for our country.
We've heard that false claim from Donald Trump about the 2020 presidential election over and over and over, despite the fact that 60 court cases found no evidence of fraud or illegality. It seems to be part of Trump's repertoire.
The election is being rigged by corrupt media pushing false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect Hillary Clinton president.
Of course, he dropped those rigged election claims after he won, but they're just below the surface of this year's election.
Republicans must win. We want to landslide. We want it to be too big to rig.
Will there be a repeat this year of the litigation frenzy that followed the 2020 election? Well, the election is still 6 months away, but political groups are filing so many lawsuits over voting rules that the numbers could reach the record set in that bitterly contested 2020 election. The Democratic and Republican parties have raised about $41.3 million to spend on court fights, and nonprofits, including some dark money groups, have likely raised hundreds of millions more. Joining me is elections law expert Derek Mueller, a professor at Notre Dame Law School. Fighting over election rules in court is big business for lawyers and the groups challenging them. Just how big?
So we know that the political parties can collect significant amounts of money earmarked, designated for election expenses. So the RNC and DNC have large pools of money, you know, that are upwards of $100 million a year now to be thinking about these kinds of expenditures. So they have significant funds that they can use to involve themselves in litigation, to start litigation, to intervene in litigation. But it's not even just the parties. It's the growth of additional 501c3s, nonprofits, organizations dedicated to rooting out voter fraud or protecting democracy or whatever we might label the organizations. And those, we don't even have a sense of the scope and scale of these things. So it's significant amounts of money coming into the system specifically for litigation.
And you've done some research on the political parties' legal expenses.
There are so many different ways of calculating the money. So I did research this. I found that this fundraising for the 2021 and 2022 election cycle among Republicans and Democrats was $154 million. So that's a two-year period for both Republicans and Democrats in a significant sort of chunk. It's an escalating figure. We won't have the figures for this next cycle. We only have the first few months of this cycle right now. But again, that's a significant amount of money specifically designated exclusively for litigation expenses.
Do we know? And I believe that's about 30 times what the party's legal expenses were back in 2003. And Congress played a role here. Tell us what happened in 2014.
Yes. So in 2014, there was what we called Cromnibus, the continuing resolution omnibus bill that has a number of provisions that people's eyes might glaze over thinking about. But as a part of that, one of the things that they did was change some of the contribution limits to the major political parties. The notion being right now you can only give, $3,300 for the primary, $3,300 for the general for a presidential candidate or a Senate candidate or whatever it might be. You can also give fixed amounts of money to the parties themselves. But the argument was, well, there's other money that we could give to the parties that would help them with their expenses that doesn't really face a risk of corruption, right? We're worried when we contribute money to candidates or the party, it looks like it's for corruption. But what if we have some kinds of earmarked expenses? For instance, running the presidential nominating conventions, if you could just designate an additional $100,000 to the parties to run their presidential nominating convention. So we added some contribution limits about 10 years ago in this bill. And one of those was a additional sort of designation for recount or other litigation expenses. At the time, that was $106,500. That gets increased for inflation over the years. But that means you can give about $120,000 now to a political party just to help it litigate, just to help it engage in election-related litigation. So there's no question that for a very long time, from about 2003 to 2014, as I track this, parties would spend about $3 to $5 million a year on litigation expenses. And now we're just seeing the earmarks just skyrocket because as the parties collect bigger and bigger checks from donors, there's only so many places for the money to go because there are other contribution limits. And one of those places now that you can give substantial amounts of money, but you can only give about $6,000 to a presidential candidate, but you can give $120,000 to the candidate's lawyers. So it's a significant mismatch that is funding this litigation.
And there are groups, nonprofits, where we don't know where their money is coming from or how they're spending it.
So when it comes to the DNC or the RNC, we know their donors. We know the individuals who have contributed to these entities. So we don't have sort of the so-called dark money groups. You know, there are limitations about what PACs can contribute to parties. So we have some transparency about where that money is coming from, at least in terms of the direct contributions to the parties. Where we can label as dark money comes in would be if there are other outside groups on the right or the left who are starting litigation, engaged in litigation, funding litigation, intervening in litigation, who want to support or promote certain kinds of laws or anticipate those ahead of the 2024 election. So you've seen some of these organizations from, you know, former government officials, you know, both on the right and the left, who support Trump, who oppose Trump. You know, I think we often think of it in those terms, maybe rather than a Republican and Democrat these days. But those organizations, you know, we don't necessarily know where their funding's coming from, who's supporting them, or the reasons why they're litigating. But when it comes to the parties, at least, we have some pretty good transparency.
This, you know, sort of fierce challenging of election laws and Mnuchin election laws, did it start after Bush v. Gore or did it start in 2020?
It keeps rising. So there's lots of inflection points. Yeah. So Professor Rick Hasson has tracked how Bush versus Gore was sort of the first wave of these things. Because Bush versus Gore, it's not just that, you know, a very small margin in Florida could affect the outcome of a presidential election. It also signified that the federal courts were open for business about how you did a recount, right? How your machines were counting ballots. So we see a steady uptick in election litigation after the 2000 election. But again, there are different inflection points that arise, you know, throughout this period of time as states introduce voter identification laws and those become a sort of rallying cry and a challenging point for different groups or different legislatures. We see just a significant uptick in litigation around those things. The Cromnibus Bill of 2014-2015 creates this mechanism for more funding in elections. You know, after the 2016 election, we see Green Party candidate Jill Stein pressing for recounts around the United States. In 2020, we see the run-up to the election is a lot of changes due to COVID, and then there's just tons of litigation being filed to challenge the rules or to request accommodations from the rules, followed by all of those challenges after the 2020 election. So every cycle just seems to be bringing its own new challenges, new crises, new rallying points to fundraise off of. You know, a lot of election laws that were enacted by legislatures in the past that might have been ignored or sort of just moved beyond and party organizers would have accommodated them or handled them now are being challenged. Almost any change to your election machinery in very basic terms, from the buying of a machine to the list maintenance of your voter rolls, gets challenged by some group on the right or the left. So we're just seeing this escalation. Again, I think part of it is the availability of funding, and maybe part of it is the awareness that parties think that very small differences can matter. And so they want to challenge as much as they can, anticipating that a small change might matter in their election.
And are the big groups that are challenging and defending these laws, are they all tied to a party or a candidate? Are any of them independent?
So a number are at least ostensibly independent, right? But a number of them do tend to file on one side or the other. So some of them will have former Republican officials, think about restoring integrity and trust in elections, the Honest Elections Project, or things like that. Or some of them will have former Democratic officials, sort of never Trump officials who are participating. Some of them, States United Democracy Center, Protect Democracy, or some of these organizations tend to file much more heavily on the Democratic side than the Republican side. So you can trace what these organizations are doing and see where their officials are. And they can't formally coordinate with the parties, right? Because if you have that coordination, it creates campaign finance problems. But instead, they are going around, they're filing litigation. And again, places maybe where the party doesn't have the resources to do it or isn't aware of it or wants another group rather than the party to be involved. That said, the parties do still have some significant involvement. I'd say the most significant party-led litigation right now is Democratic National Committee leading a number of challenges to keep Robert F. Kennedy's name off the ballot in a number of states, I think viewing him as a third-party threat. I think the RNC might view him as a threat too, but hasn't filed those challenges. So again, it's hard to pin down exactly who's leading the litigation in some of these places. It's following the headlines, seeing who's led on the docket, what the lead party's name is, and then trying to identify, you know, who they tend to support or where their attorneys have come from.
Prominent Democratic lawyer Mark Elias said that some of these new Republican groups are emerging to launch mass voter challenges against unsuspecting voters, and he called the groups vigilantes.
We can think about this in a couple of different ways. And I think attorneys like Mr. Elias and others have long represented the Democratic Party, but then they also represent private or civic organizations, right? And there's no question that some of these organizations, like the NAACP, the ACLU, have long been involved in voting litigation. Now, at the same time, there are other organizations that, you know, they seem to be popping up a new one almost every week, right? And there are lots of individuals who believe that elections need to be run or administered in a particular way. They think they have the key to being able to set up the litigation. They think that other organizations somehow are failing or have not stepped into the breach. And they're able to set up a pitch and maybe get donors to contribute and provide the opportunity to litigate. And if you have these organizations cropping up and they are going out and they are challenging things that maybe wouldn't have been challenged in the past, or an organization that is jumping up for the first time and filing these lawsuits, and maybe they're ill-considered and likely to lose, you know, I mean, you can call them vigilantes as they step out there and step into the breach. At the same time, the courts are going to have the final say, right? When you file the lawsuit, it's not like you win. It's not like you get the election law changed or struck down or the administrative procedure adjusted. It does increase the amount of litigation we see. It increases the strain on courts. And I do think it increases some of the perceptions that the public might have that these elections are just under constant scrutiny by the courts and subject to judicial decrees, which is, I don't think, a situation we want to find ourselves in. But, you know, to the extent that the courts are open for business and open to hearing these challenges, I think we're going to continue to see more of them.
Coming up next, which state has the most unsettled questions around its election procedures? This is Bloomberg.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/GreenFestival.
The 2024 U.S. election is already being fought in the courts. Political groups, some backed by anonymous donors, are launching so many lawsuits over voting rules this year that the numbers could approach the record set in the bitterly contested 2020 election. I've been talking to elections law expert Derek Mueller, a professor at Notre Dame Law School. Do you think that with all these lawsuits, the more you have courts deciding these issues, the more voters think that the fix is in, or their vote doesn't count, or, you know, the system is just screwed up?
I mean, it's very hard, right? I mean, I think there's no question that a lot of voters after 2000, a lot of Democrats feel like the court decided the election. And that they lost it because of the judiciary. I think there are a lot of Republicans after the 2020 election who say, you know, we didn't get our chance. We didn't get a chance to sort of present our evidence in the courts. And you see this with other candidacies. It's Stacey Abrams in Georgia and Carrie Lake in Arizona. And you can go on down the line. You can find Democrats and Republicans for different reasons and with different degrees of legitimacy arguing that the election was stacked against them, or that, you know, charges that the election was rigged in some way. You know, it's not good rhetoric. It's not good language. It's not good for the public to have those things being said by officials, and then to have the courts that step in, or they're even blamed when they don't step in. You know, it leaves us in a pretty precarious spot in the United States. Again, I think the presumption was, and you can even think about this in 2000, that when an official lost, the official would concede and move on, and we would sort of just prepare for the next election. Now we realize there's tremendous fundraising power in rejecting election results and denying legitimacy of the winner, that voters actually get motivated and encouraged by that, by wanting to contribute to candidates who claim they've been wronged, that an election has been stolen. So it's a very precarious spot for us as a democracy. If we increasingly have a system where the people believe that if their candidate loses, it's an illegitimate election, and that when those words are spoken actually incentivizes them to contribute money to the political consultants who are making those claims, it's not a good place for us. And I don't know what's going to change that unless we have a true sea change culture in how political operations and litigation are being run in the United States. And that's not an easy thing.
You know, when you read about the lawsuits, it seems like the vast majority, and maybe it's because these are the ones that get attention, are not helping to clarify things, but they're attacking this minutia to deter the process.
So I think about this from kind of an economic standpoint. If you have limited resources to challenge the rules governing elections, you are going to challenge the things that you think are the biggest deal, right? The most important ones, the ones that you think are really, truly changing the game. And that's also the case that if you didn't have money earmarked for litigation, as a campaign, you would have to make a judgment call. Do I think this $250,000 is better spent on advertisements in our district or on litigating, you know, this absentee voter rule or this Dropbox rule or whatever it is? So in the past, you would focus your resources on those things that were the most salient issues that you thought had the highest likelihood of winning, and those things that you thought were better uses of resources than sort of ordinary political expenses. Now, when you earmark the funds, you are saying this money is for only litigation. These contributions can only be for litigation purposes. So you don't have to make that trade-off. And the more resources you have, the more money you have to spend on litigation, then the more things you can challenge. And the more things you challenge, by definition, you are challenging weaker and weaker claims or more and more marginal claims, more and more minutia of elections to say, you know, we're dealing with a very small subset of what we think could be at stake here. So we can say, you know, at a very high level, of course, we want elections to be run fairly and with integrity. We want every eligible voter to have a reasonable opportunity to vote, and we don't want that vote unreasonably burdened. But we now expect a lot of things, even what we could describe as fairly small things, about how elections are run, you know, in terms of how counties are purchasing voting equipment or the methods they use to tabulate ballots are just being routinely challenged. So I take less and less stock each day as I read the headlines about a new lawsuit being filed, because, you know, many of these lawsuits just don't go anywhere. They're not going to end up being successful, or even if they're successful at the district court level, they're likely to be reversed on appeal, because I think the more litigation we see, just there's a lower likelihood of success of each ensuing lawsuit. So watching that escalation and trying to calculate what's the actual added value at the end of the day, how much of it is win-loss rate, and how much of it is convincing donors or convincing those who you fundraise from to say, hey, we've filed a lawsuit. We're fighting. We're fighting the fight. And even if we lose, the point is we're fighting. So that's been a change in the dynamic, I would say, over the last couple of decades.
You think that Pennsylvania is the state with the most unsettled questions around its election procedures, and we are coming close to the election? What is unsettled in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, Pennsylvania is definitely the place I've been looking at for years. And we saw it after 2020, we saw it before 2020, and we're seeing it again before 2024. It's a combination of factors. It's a Republican-controlled legislature with a Democratic governor, you know, its own challenge in a number of places. But there seems to be an unusual recalcitrance inside the state to try to address or resolve some of these issues. It's issues that have been known about how absentee ballots are processed in the state, and especially if there's an uptick in absentee ballots after the 2020 election, about what kinds of information is required to count the ballots. Ambiguities in the statutes that have left the state Supreme Court in its own internal difficulties thinking about remedies. It advising the legislature to provide some clarity, and again, the legislature refusing to provide that clarity. It's also the fact that Pennsylvania is not just a closely contested state. You know, there are many closely contested states. It's a large state, so there are a number of electoral votes in play if we're thinking about the presidential election. And it's a state with some of the most significant local discretion to election officials. So you think about different systems where the Secretary of State provides more guidance, and that gives some uniform clarity for how county officials do their job when the legislature has created some ambiguities or left a place for the administration of laws. In Pennsylvania, you don't have that. So you have a lot of counties doing individualized things. In some places, you know, there might be 10 different standards across the state about how they're supposed to handle a particular issue. That creates an equal protection problem. If similarly situated voters are being treated differently across the state, that also spurs more litigation to figure out what the uniform rule needs to be or where there can be deviation. So these county officials in the different jurisdictions have also sort of failed to coordinate with each other and have very strongly held views individually about how the elections should be administered. So it's a series of issues that we have known for several years that the legislature, and it's really, I think, the legislature and the governor have failed to lead and failed to act in a way to protect the elections in the state and to provide some clarity. And there's no question, I think Republicans and Democrats might think very differently about how the election should be administered, but I think to the extent that you can bargain for some agreement about that and provide that guidance would go much, much farther to protecting the rights of everyone involved rather than sitting back, waiting to see what happens. And if it's close enough, litigating it and trying to stave off a disaster. But, you know, I'm not in the legislature there. I'm not in the governor's office there trying to figure out what that looks like, a different political climate. But it's the reality of what we see in a state like Pennsylvania.
It sounds like it'll be a nightmare for 2024.
The election administrator's prayer is for wide margins, right?
Mm-hmm.
The question is, you know, if Pennsylvania is decided by 5 points, nobody cares, right? If it's decided by less than one percentage point or, you know, whatever you view as sufficiently close, then you have more and more litigation around it. So there's no question there's going to be significant attention to Pennsylvania for how close the election is, the size of the electoral votes at stake. And then, of course, you have these decentralized issues that remain a constant source of litigation in the state.
Arizona got a lot of attention after the 2020 election with armed people intimidating voters. You had the conspiracy theories and the recounts. Is that likely to happen again this year?
It's hard to know. So Carrie Lake, who lost the governor's election in 2022, is running for Senate. How much has she learned her lesson about losing? How much does she want to redouble those efforts? It's hard to know. You know, I think there were some particular concerns that came out of COVID and a lot of changes about elections during COVID, more absentee ballots, drop boxes, things like that. You know, and then again, some people who, you know, would sell movies or books preying on people's fears without sort of material evidence, resulting in, yeah, a federal injunction against one of these organizations that was providing armed surveillance at some drop boxes in the state. You know, I think, you know, we watch the primaries, we see if things are calmer then as opposed to what they were in 2022. We'll see how wide the margins are. But, you know, I think the question for the Republican Party in Arizona is, look, despite all this stuff, we've lost significantly. We've lost a lot of offices in this state. You know, we've lost both U.S. Senate seats. We've lost the state in the presidential election. We've lost essentially all of the executive offices in the state in the last election. Is it time to think about a new playbook? I'm thinking about encouraging voters rather than telling our voters that the system is rigged. You know, again, it's just a lot of speculation about what kinds of fears are going to be drummed up in these jurisdictions, or what kinds of people are trying to make a quick buck by selling people conspiracy theories, and at what point know, political organizations and say the Republican National Committee steps into the state and says, look, you can't keep destroying our own credibility in terms of how elections are administered, because if you are constantly telling people that the election is rigged, they won't show up and Republicans will lose. So we'll see how much self-interest is there as well. But there's no question that some of the highest temperature was in the state of Arizona, and we'll see if that carries through in 2024.
Finally, could 2024 be worse as far as litigation, election litigation, than the endless litigation we saw after the 2020 presidential election?
Well, it could be. It always depends on how close it is, right? The closer the margin, the more litigation. Now, we say that, you know, 2020 in a way wasn't particularly close because you would have had to flip several states with somewhat significant margins of victory in those jurisdictions, even after a recount in places like Georgia. So we'll have to see, you know, if it's a Republican loss or an apparent Republican loss. There are a number of attorneys who promoted things in 2020 and filed lawsuits who are facing sanctions or have been disbarred. And I don't know if that's going to be sobering for attorneys on the Republican side to think about the quality of the claims they bring to be more limited and constrained. And again, it depends on the size of the loss, the scope of the loss. And many of the strategies in 2020 turn on allegations that states changed their laws in the middle of the pandemic inappropriately. You're not going to see that kind of dynamic effect in 2024. And there are changes to the Electoral Count Reform Act that sort of tighten some of the deadlines and force governors to submit certificates in an earlier and more timely fashion. So I think there's a decent chance we would see less litigation on that front. For Democrats in a close loss, again, it's hard to know exactly what that would look like. You know, how many resources would be focused on certain jurisdictions to allege there are violations of federal law? Again, I think it depends on the kinds of jurisdictions where places like Pennsylvania, where you have more disparate methods in how ballots are counted across counties, you have more opportunities to bring those challenges and to try to get more absentee or other kinds of ballots counted, which might redound to the benefits of whichever candidate is trailing at the time and trying to bring these challenges. But it's a high degree of uncertainty. We might see more in 2024. And, you know, I go back to 2020. We didn't see a lot of states with litigation. We just saw a lot of litigation concentrated in one state. Now, it did culminate in one case, Bush versus Gore, but there was still a lot of litigation happening there. I think the thing about 2020 that was more remarkable was seeing how diffuse and spread out the litigation was. So I think that's less likely to see that kind of litigation spread out. But if the election turns on a close result in one or two states, and not just four or five states, I would not be surprised to see a significant uptick in litigation.
I guess we should all hope then for wide margins. Thanks so much, Derek. That's Professor Derek Muller of Notre Dame Law School. Coming up next, why Trump's social media company is awash in legal cases. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Donald Trump's newly public social media company is entangled in many legal cases. The bulk of them involve suspected misdeeds by the executives who helped set the company up and merge it with a public entity, and by the former president himself. The cases are entangled and very confusing. Here to help us sort it all out is Bloomberg legal reporter Greg Farrell. Greg, start where it started. Truth Social.
So after the election, after Trump lost, after the January 6th riots on Capitol Hill, Trump found that he was no longer welcome at most of the major social media sites, especially Twitter. And he decided in the aftermath of that to set up his own company, his own, you know, social media platform, Truth Social, as it's known, and to take it public and turn it into, you know, a source of wealth would be difficult on its own. But as you know, and as we've written a lot about here at Bloomberg, SPACs had become very popular a few years ago around this time. And a SPAC, a special purpose acquisition company, is a vehicle, a way for investors, you know, investment companies to take companies public without going through the usual process of filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission themselves and subjecting themselves to all sorts of internal disclosures about a company. It removes that by, I'm simplifying here, but it removes that process by one step.
Simple is good.
Allowing a blank check company, essentially, to raise money and say, you know, if you invest with us, we will use your money to buy at least one or more companies, and we have a track record of investments, and if you trust us, we'll go find something and take it public, and your investment in us will increase, you know, double, triple, whatever, but we will increase. So the special purpose acquisition companies are the ones that go public. So once Trump announced he was going to have his own social media company, that was obviously a desirable target, you know, for any special purpose acquisition company because, you know, name recognition, the former president of the United States, possibly future president of the United States, it was very attractive. So Digital World Acquisition Corporation was established by a guy named Patrick Orlando, and it went public in September of 2021, and its statements, according to its filings to potential investors, it had not entered into any discussions with any entity. It was a blank check company that was going to scan the horizon and look for good investments. And it went public as it was successful. And shortly thereafter, there was an announcement that it was going to bring Trump Media Technology Group public. So that's the origin story in 2021 of what we're now seeing playing out.
Let's talk about some of the lawsuits.
Yes.
Several involve Patrick Orlando, the ex-CEO and I think still current director of Digital World Acquisition.
Now it's DJT. It's Trump Media Technology Group, but it's trading ticker DJT on the terminal.
I wonder where they got that.
And you get financials and everything. So, right, when DWAC went public, when the Digital World Acquisition Company went public, its primary sponsor was a fund called ARK Global Investments. But ARK Global Investments is basically Patrick Orlando's fund. He's the managing partner in it. So he was the principal investor that helped bring Digital World Acquisition public. And therefore, he became, after it succeeded in its IPO, the chairman and chief executive officer. He lasted in that job until early 2023 when he was fired. And he was fired because the Securities and Exchange Commission was investigating him and Digital World Acquisition Company because it had uncovered evidence that Patrick Orlando, before DWAC went public, had been negotiating or at least expressed interest in buying Trump Media Technology Group. And it's not so much that that was doing something wrong as much as in its disclosures, in order to go public, DWAC had said it had not committed to anything or held any discussions with any other party, you know, but invest here and then we will go find after this, you know, go seek out acquisitions. And that was patently false because he had, in fact, negotiated or at least had discussions with the Trump Media Organization to take that public. So the SEC investigation led to an $18 million settlement with the company. Patrick Orlando was ousted as CEO, but not as a board member. He got to stay on, and he was going to stay on, and the plan was until such time as DWAC did, in fact, make an acquisition. And after a couple of years, it finally closed this spring on March 22nd was the date for, you know, shareholders, including ARK Global Investments, to vote whether or not to approve the deal with Trump Media Technology Group. So that's step two.
That was a drop-dead date, March 22nd?
Yes, right. And there's some leverage here on several of the parties here. If the vote didn't occur, or if it went the wrong way, then Digital World Acquisition Group would be obligated to liquidate. In other words, return the funds to investors. These special purpose acquisition companies don't go on forever. When they go public and raise money, they have a timetable, and it's much shorter than the period here, but there were several delays that extended it. And if nothing happened by March 22nd, then DWAC would have to basically return shares funds to his investing partners and miss out on this opportunity to take Trump Media public.
Now, at this point, as you write in your piece, the lawsuits began to fly, but none of the lawsuits stopped the merger.
Correct. As this date was approaching, several lawsuits were filed. Several of them involved Patrick Orlando. So for one, Digital World Acquisition Corp. sued him because it was clear that in his role as director, according to DWAC, they claimed that he was basically, you know, subverting the acquisition process. Not jettisoning it, but subverting it in such a way as to favor himself. He wanted a better, you know, set of shares or a better conversion ratio for ARK Global Investments holdings in DWAC in the post-conversion deal with Trump Media. DWAC had determined that at least from day one, once the vote went through and the acquisition occurred, that holders, including ARC Global, would get 1.34 shares in the new company, what became TJT, for every one share they already held in DWAC. Orlando had signaled as a board member that he thought it should be much higher, as high as 1.8. So there was clearly going to be a battle over this in the last 4 weeks leading up to the vote. So DWAC sued him, you know, preemptively in Florida in mid-February. He responded by filing a countersuit, if you will, in Delaware by the end of February, saying, no, it should be 1.78 to 1. You guys have miscalculated. You've made misstatements about me, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the beginning of this. Patrick Orlando sued DWAC for payment of legal fees because he was racking up legal bills because of the SEC investigation. And it was clear from one of DWAC's lawsuits that the SEC was going to investigate and quite possibly bring a civil charge against Orlando for making those misstatements about Trump Media in the run-up to the IPO. And that was resolved beforehand, so presumably DWAC did pay much, if not all, of the legal expenses that Patrick Orlando incurred as a director of DWAC for the SEC investigation.
So the suit by the Trump Media co-founders, the former contestants on The Apprentice,
yes,
was that part of the DWAC suit? I mean, it's also about contentions that Trump was trying to dilute their stake.
Yes, it's related insofar as there was going to be a transition. You know, they helped found this company in 2021, so they thought their stake was worth X, or that was their understanding in early documents. But over time, you know, as the company got a little more mature or approached this date of acquisition, they learned that their shares were worth less than what they believed. So they sued. And again, part of this was not only to get a larger cut of the share to which they felt they deserved, but with the deal coming up, it's a potential point of leverage that we want more, either or else. I'm not sure they could, you know, undermine it, or they could get it delayed further. So that was resolved. The Delaware Chancery Court judge overseeing that matter said no, he was not going to postpone or force this March 22nd vote to be rescheduled, but would simply, you know, sort out the issue of ownership afterwards, because there'd be a large chunk of unallocated shares in the wake of the March 22nd acquisition.
So now Trump has countersued, but in Florida. And here's my favorite part. The judge, Samuel Glasscock III, said he was gobsmacked to learn of Trump's Florida suit, which he filed there instead of bringing counterclaims in the Delaware suit, and that he would consider possible sanctions against the former president.
Yes, Judge Glasscock, I've seen him. He's excellent, and there's real rules regarding Delaware Chancery Court and, you know, a pattern of the way you prosecute or litigate things, and this was clearly stepping out of something that was brought in Chancery Court and trying to drag it down to Florida. So we'll see what happens, but right, he did not, you know, earn any favors, Trump's lawyers, by suing in Florida rather than, you know, taking this or dealing with this in Chancery Court.
And then also, there's an insider trading case where...
Yes, as if that weren't enough. Exactly.
It's crazy. There's civil litigation between the parties, the SEC bringing suits, and the Manhattan U.S. attorney bringing a criminal case.
So over and above the current spat, you know, different legal questions about who owns how much of the new company, TJT, is this other fact that one of the early investors, Bruce Gorelick, who was affiliated with Rocket Mortgage, learned and was aware of, before the public became aware of, DWAC's interest in doing a deal with Trump Media. Now, that's valuable information. If you've got a blank check company and they haven't decided where to spend their money, it's worth whatever it's worth. If you happen to know before it's announced that, no, they're going to do a deal for Donald Trump's media company, a very high-profile, almost can't-miss kind of bet, then that's worth something. And the Justice Department accused him and a couple of Confederates, whom we knew through Rocket Mortgage, the Schwartzman brothers, of insider trading, of misappropriating the information about this, sharing it with friends, and then trading on it, buying more DWAC shares, and then selling the DWAC shares once the news about its plan to acquire Trump Media Technology Group came out. And all three, you know, were determined to fight it. They pled not guilty. But, you know, just last week or 2 weeks ago, the Schwartzman brothers both changed their plea to guilty. So, you know, Gorelick hasn't, but now he's, you know, in a little bit of trouble. Not only has he been charged with insider trading, but two men who the government alleges he shared this with have both pled guilty. So we'll see what happens with his case. But yes, it has nothing directly to do with Trump, but it's not a good fact pattern if you're trying to launch a company that this has happened in the background. And this helped delay the launch of the company.
And just what is DJT worth? There have been these wild swings in the shares. And it's a company that's never generated a profit, yet it's worth billions?
Not only no profit, but it's barely generated any revenue. It's created losses. That's what we've seen in its first public filings after this acquisition. But, you know, you and I grew up in a world where people who pick stocks, you know, obsessed over the fundamentals, how much money it would generate, and, you know, this is why you bought a company and had a brand value, et cetera. We're in a different world now of meme stocks. And mm-hmm. I think this is actually ingenious, you know, on Trump's half. He has a bunch of MAGA supporters, you know, his real ardent fans who do put their money where their mouth is. They buy his merchandise. They support him. They give him money. And this is a way of giving money to him as well. Whether or not they can keep the stock up at its level, even though it doesn't have the underlying revenues to justify it at this time. I remember growing up in the Boston area at some point in the 1980s, a group of investors took the Boston Celtics public. Now, the Celtics were, you know, at the height of their fame and success in the 1980s with Larry Bird, and it was a stock play, like, you know, let's get a lot of Boston Celtics fans and Boston sports fans, you know, get them to buy into it. It was not ultimately a success, but I see on a much larger scale sort of a similar enticement here. You know, Trump has tens of millions of passionate supporters, and to ask them to buy a share of stock for 40 or 50 bucks or whatever, who knows if he mobilizes them, you know, what he could get them to do.
Well, they want to buy his $400 sneakers. They're sold out. They buy the mugs, the T-shirts, and everything else. So we shall see.
This is interesting. This, you know, gets us away from, like I say, fundamental, you know, stock analysis and what the return on investment be to, like, no, this is what, you know, Trump's passionate supporters might run up.
Yeah.
We'll see. This will be an interesting test case. There will be some kind of a business school case study probably written on this.
And maybe law school, too. We'll see.
Yes, maybe.
Thanks so much, Greg, for unraveling all these lawsuits. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Greg Farrell. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.